In 1978, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was passed to protect against discrimination based on pregnancy, childbirth, or other related medical conditions. But 40 years later, how well is the Pregnancy Discrimination Act protecting the modern workforce? Deborah Dinner is an associate law professor at Emory University, and she joins me now. Deborah, thanks for being with us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So tell us, how is this law meant to protect pregnant women?
Well, what the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978 does, and I'll call it the PDA, is it amends Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And Title VII is the law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, as well as race, color, religion, and national origin. And what the PDA does is it defines sex discrimination to include pregnancy and discrimination on the basis of related medical conditions, including childbirth.
So what are some of the limitations to this law? I understand it's a conditional law. Can you tell us what that means?
So what the Pregnancy Discrimination Act does is it says that you can't refuse to hire someone just because she's pregnant, or you can't deny a promotion to pregnant women because you have stereotypes about motherhood. And it requires that pregnant persons and persons affected by childbirth be treated just the same as other persons who are similar in, quote, their ability or inability to work. It's a requirement effectively of same treatment. So the biggest limitation of the PDA is that it's only an anti-discrimination mandate, and it leaves many workers bereft of protection. And so what it doesn't require doesn't guarantee an affirmative entitlement to an accommodation in the workplace. So let's imagine a managerial professional in a Fortune 500 company who's fortunate enough and lucky enough to work in a workplace that gives generous paid leave. So if she broke her leg, she could get, say, 4 weeks of paid leave. Similarly, if she became pregnant and needed leave before childbirth or after childbirth, she could get 4 weeks of paid childbirth because she would be treated the same. But let's imagine people who work in warehouses, like in the recent New York Times article. They work in low-income jobs where they are much less likely to have generalized protections for disability. So there, the employer gives no light-duty accommodations to any worker when they fall ill. In that workplace, an anti-discrimination mandate does not get you very far. So just the requirement under the PDA that pregnant workers be treated the same as other temporarily disabled workers doesn't get them much protection. So they won't be given light duty, which poses a risk to their health and the health of their fetuses.
Now, I wonder, does this have anything to do with the fact that pregnancy is considered a disability clause in this law? Because it feels like we're treating pregnancy the same as we would a quote-unquote disability and not as a separate category. Is that right?
Yeah. The law, it's important to recognize, does not actually mention the word disability. What the law says is that sex discrimination under Title VII includes pregnancy. And then it gives an example. And it says that, for example, pregnant women should get the same benefits as other employees who are similar or in their ability or inability to work. So it might be helpful to explain a little bit where this idea of temporary disability came from. Feminist lawyers in the 70s were really worried that any law that specially protected pregnant women would lead to hiring discrimination. And so they promoted kind of an approach that was sex neutral, that analogized between pregnancy and temporary disability in order to use anti-discrimination as a kind of bootstrap to get pregnant women some of the benefits that were available for temporarily disabled workers generally, and to prohibit employment discrimination on the basis of pregnancy. But again, this leaves the workers who most need protection bereft of protection because it doesn't provide a positive entitlement to the kinds of accommodations that are necessary for the health and safety of pregnant workers.
Now, how much has this law changed in the past 40 years, and what do you see as the future of it?
Yeah, I think the law has evolved. So, for example, in the 2015 decision, Young v. UPS, the Supreme Court expanded what would count as disparate treatment on the basis of pregnancy, or what would count as kind of the differential treatment of pregnancy that was unlawful. So if an employer, for example, gives accommodations to a large percentage of its workforce, for whatever reason, but not to pregnant workers, that now can be considered unlawful. Another advance in the law we've seen is that stereotyping pregnant women is itself in a way that leads to kind of an adverse employment action, a firing or a failure to promote or a denial of benefits, that those kinds of gender stereotypes are themselves unlawful.
What gender stereotypes are you referring to?
Well, for example, I think that one of the Coles, the woman from New Jersey who was told by her supervisor that she needed to take more time off work or have a kind of less demanding job because she should spend more time with the baby. Those are the kinds of gender stereotypes that are actually still very prevalent. The notion that a new mother won't be able to be as committed to the workforce because she's now committed to her child more than she is to her job. Those are the kinds of gender stereotypes that could be probative of unlawful sex discrimination under the PDA.
Deborah Dinner is associate law professor at Emory University, and she has a book coming out called The Sex Equality Dilemma, Work, Family, and Legal Change in Neoliberal America. Deborah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.